As children move into early adolescence and start to develop into young men and women, they also start to take on these ingrained social roles of what they should say and do, how they should dress, how they should be. The gender roles they take on have huge implications for their own health and well-being and that of people around them. Dr. Robert Bloom is the senior professor at Johns Hopkins University Bloomberg School of Public Health. He directed a study titled, It Begins at 10, How Gender Expectations Shape Early Adolescence Around the World. Dr. Bloom, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I was surprised to hear that this is a first-of-its-kind study. It seems like we should be very closely watching the development in early adolescence and gender identity. Tell us about how the study came to be.
Well, I agree with you that it is a gap in knowledge that for us is also surprising. So when you look at research, most research on adolescence begins at 14 or 15 years of age. It assumes that actually young adolescents, 10 to 14 or so, it's sort of like a continuation of childhood, and things don't really rev up until later. And we also know that the issues around gender norms, the messages boys and girls get, what it means to be a girl and a boy, they hear them from childhood. They hear them from infancy, and they see it. But it's during this early adolescent period when they become solidified, when they become, after that time, really hard to influence and change. And so that's why we focused in that age group. We were in 15 countries on 5 continents.
It's a huge study, so many researchers, and 450 interviews with these early adolescents and their parents or guardians. Describe who these kids were in your study.
Well, these were all young people who lived in the poorest sections of some of the poorest cities in the world. They lived in the slums in Malawi, in the Congo, in Burkina Faso, in Ecuador, in China, in India. And so there were 400 young people, 450 young people, and matched with a pair. And in each place, our colleagues did in-depth interviews separate from parent and child. And we're very open-ended. We wanted to understand how young people experience the change from childhood into adolescence. What messages did they get from their mothers, their fathers, brothers, sisters, friends, from faith leaders, etc.? And we went and spoke with the parent to understand what they saw to be the changes this generation is experiencing in Shanghai or in Hanoi or in Delhi, compared to what they experienced when they were growing up.
So you are comparing and contrasting between generations.
Yes, very definitely. And we also wanted to hear the concerns that parents had. And very honestly, when we started out this work, many people, including funders who we went to, when we said we were interested in this, they said, why bother? There is so much difference. What would young people growing up in Baltimore have in common with young people growing up in Cape Town or in Hanoi? We found that not to be true, in fact. We found a huge amount of similarity.
And so you must have been combing through a whole lot of interviews and listening for common threads.
It's exactly what we did. We listened for common threads. And so, for example, we extracted every gendered message that kids had. And in the first 300 interviews with just the young people, we pulled out over 3,300 gendered messages. So it is a big undertaking.
And give us an example of a gendered message.
Oh, you know, you can't sit like that, sweetheart, any longer. What do you mean I can't sit like? You can't sit like that. You know, you're too old for that now. A girl in Shanghai. She said, what do you mean? Why? Her father responded, you know. Well, she was wise enough to not say to her father, I don't know. But she didn't know. So later she said, I spoke with my mother. And mother said, well, now that you're an adolescent, you can't cross your legs like that anymore. Girls' messages you can't go out looking like that. You've got to change what you wear. Boys' messages about changing clothes. Boys' messages, you can't play with her anymore. These are all messages kids around the world hear once they start into puberty, that no longer can you be friends with each other. You have to keep that up. Why? Because boys are danger. What kind of danger are they? You know, they're dangerous. Well, I don't know. He was my best friend. He wasn't dangerous 6 months ago. Why is he dangerous now? And these are all things kids hear. The bullying and teasing is very sexualized. The messages from parents are very sexualized, and it's mostly about girls' risk and boys overpowering them.
We're talking right now with Dr. Robert Bloom. He is a senior professor at Johns Hopkins University Bloomberg School of Public Health. He directed a study titled It Begins at 10, How Gender Expectations Shape Early Adolescence Around the World, recently published in the Journal of Adolescent Health. You can join in this discussion about gender stereotypes, 800-642-1234. Send an email to ideas@wpr.org. What were your experiences growing up as a boy or a girl? Do you think enforcing gender stereotypes among children have negative effects? 800-642-1234. What do you tell your son or daughter about gender roles? You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dr. Bloom, you worked with researchers all over the world. Were they as concerned and curious about these common issues, concerns coming up with these young girls around the world as you are as a researcher?
Very definitely they were. Let's talk about why. What difference does it make? Well, around the world, we see girls being sent off to be married at very young age. And when I talk about very young age, I'm talking about 15 years of age or younger. So early child marriage. Secondly, teen pregnancy. Big issue. Now, teen pregnancy has been going down in the United States, and most teen pregnancy here occurs outside of marriage. But around the world, most teen pregnancy is the result of being married at a very young age. You have high mortality rates in childhood from pregnancy. HIV, most of Africa, for example, HIV disproportionately is young girls, not young men. So you have this whole set of risk factors for girls, but you also have a whole set of risk factors for boys. I mean, just think about Wisconsin. Who smokes cigarettes more, boys or girls? Who drinks more, boys or girls? Who gets into fights more? Who dies in automobile accidents more, boys or girls? It's all boys. Boys' mortality risk is greater than girls, and it's not because of the genetic basis for it. It's a social role basis for it. So we see this around the world. Girls being victimized by gender-based violence and bullying is breathtakingly stunning. And you know what else is stunning about that? Is boys think this is their prerogative. It's their right to do this. Now you say, how can this be? But think about if you're 40 years of age or older, the notion when we were growing up that boys will be boys.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But what does that mean? That means that those kind of aggressive gendered norms are really cool. And they're really acceptable.
And passed down from one generation to the next.
Exactly.
And we're going to come back to that in just a moment. We're talking with Dr. Robert Bloom, director of this Global Early Adolescent Study at Johns Hopkins University. You can join in, 800-642-1234. How did it feel for you growing up as a boy or a girl? Do you think enforcing gender stereotypes should be should have negative consequences? 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Back after this news. In most cultures around the world, girls understand by the age of 10 that their bodies are both an asset and a problem. Just one of a number of takeaways in the Global Early Adolescent Study. Dr. Robert Bloom of Johns Hopkins University led the study. The researchers found that children internalize the belief that boys are strong and independent while girls are weak and dependent. We're unpacking these gender stereotypes this hour. You can join in, 800-642-1234. Do you think we need to shift the way we socialize boys and girls and how we teach them about gender norms? What's been your experience? How do you talk to your children about gender roles? 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go right to the phones now with Laura in Oshkosh. Good morning, Laura.
Good morning. I'm a sixth grade teacher, so I work with 10 and 11-year-olds. And recently, the students in social studies wrote essays on a period of history that interests them the most. And it was interesting and kind of scary to me when I read several of the male essays. They chose war periods, and they said things in their essays like, I'm so glad I studied World War II because nuclear bombs are so awesome. And war is, you know, it is great to read about war. And I love to see when people get killed. And in general, the girls wrote about the culture of ancient history periods, and they wrote about the food and about the homes and about the animals. And it was just such a difference between the two, and they're so young. I mean, where does that come from?
Dr. Bloom?
Well, I hear clearly what you're saying. What it comes from is an entire cultural perspective that men orient to and that males orient to and that boys hear forever growing up of power, of control, of aggression. And so all of these children's stories, fantasies, play out that way. Girls, conversely, from a very young age, get messages about frailty, about being soft, about deferring to elders and seniors and parents and teachers, about deferring to men. And so what you hear and see, even in children's play and fantasy world, is this playing out. When we hear it and see it, we're sort of shocked. So, you know, then parents who say, oh, well, so we don't allow our son to play with guns. But that's not the issue. It's not about playing with guns or not playing with guns. It is about the messages relentlessly that they get about power and control. And guns are just but one snippet about power and control. But we see it in every arena about our lives.
Laura, thanks so much for your call. Let's take another call from Oshkosh. David, go ahead. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call this morning. I just wanted to bring up a point of there was a psychologist, I believe her name was Kim Wallen, who did a study with rhesus monkeys and the toys that they preferred. And they found that the male rhesus monkeys preferred toys with wheels and more male gender appropriate toys. And the female monkeys preferred softer plush toys, more typical female gender toys. Now, they are absent of cultural and advertising influences. And I think there's a very important evolutionary standpoint to gender roles that we cannot afford to squash. And the more we try to thin away the skin and blur those lines, the more we wind up with situations like the students at Berkeley and Antifa and all these other sensitive groups who can't take counterpoint to what they personally believe and are offended by everything.
David, thanks. Dr. Bloom, does evolution play a role here?
So you raised both an interesting and important point. So let's start with something very fundamental. The goal of this research, and research like this, is not to say boys and girls should be the same. For 1,000,000,000 reasons, boys and girls should not be the same, and they are not the same. There are biologic bases to a vast number of things. So is there a biologic basis to male aggression? You bet there is. Is it, if you live in the wilderness, is it adaptive? Yes, it is. So in many animal societies, males leave the home sooner than females. Males go out and conquer females for sex and procreation. And that aggression allows them to procreate. So if you think at the animal level that you're referring to, the rhesus monkey, we see it in lions, we see it in a wide range, that that level of aggression is adaptive. One would like to believe, however, that for human beings, we are not simply functioning at the level of aggressive procreation and survival, that we have a higher order of thinking. So while I totally agree that it's critically important to acknowledge the biologic basis for these differences, we also need to acknowledge the harm. The harm is that girls are victimized by bullying and sexual aggression, by rape and sexual assault, logarithmically more than boys. The reality is that at age 10, about 9% of boys and 9% of girls experience depression. By the age of 16, it is double for girls than it is for boys. Girls' depression goes up logarithmically. Boys' depression stays the same. Is that a good thing to say, wow, that's just terrific. This is by all biology. Uh-uh. It's not. It is how we socialize our kids, and they pay a high price for it. And it's not just girls who pay a high price. Boys do. And at the end of the day, guys, we pay a high price. Remember, the odds are high that you're going to die before your spouse. And a lot of the explanation for that is not biologic, it is sociologic.
What's so remarkable, Dr. Bloom, about the age of 10? What's the tipping point about age 10?
Well, age 10 itself isn't so remarkable, but we need to keep in mind that the age of puberty has declined steadily. So if you look, for example, between 1860 and 1960, and this is in the United States, Canada, Europe, the age of puberty went down about 2 to 3 months per decade. It began to plateau and then started to decline again around 1995 to 2000. So kids are entering into puberty now earlier. When I say earlier, I'm talking about the third grade, that they begin to enter into puberty, and girls before boys. So what makes this age group important to focus on is that, first of all, there are these dramatic biologic changes with earlier physical maturation, both for boys and for girls, and that we know that these roles, that they come to buy into, become pretty solidified by the time they're 14 or 15.
Talking right now with Dr. Robert Bloom. He is a senior professor at Johns Hopkins University's Bloomberg School of Public Health and directed a study titled It Begins at 10, How Gender Expectations Shape Early Adolescence Around the World. You can join into this conversation, 800-642-1234. Do you see gender roles playing out in your life for your children as well? 800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dr. Bloom, you bring up puberty, and it's interesting because in recent years, Always, the feminine hygiene products brand, launched the hashtag Like a Girl campaign, and it's, you know, we're seeing companies like Nike, like Hasbro with Barbie's Imagine the Possibilities, taking a completely different spin on what's happening to girls. They're marketing the issue. And I want to hear a bit of the Always campaign. They say is to keep girls' confidence high during puberty and beyond. Let's listen.
My name is Dakota, and I'm 10 years old.
Show me what it looks like to run like a girl. Grow like a girl. Fight like a girl. What does it mean to you when I say run like a girl?
It means run fast as you can.
So do you think you just insulted your sister?
No. I mean, yeah, insulted girls, but not my sister.
Is like a girl a good thing?
Actually, I don't know what it really, if it's a bad thing or a good thing.
Dr. Bloom, what do we know about ad campaigns like this, how they're working, what's behind them?
Well, first of all, anyone listening to this program, I would really urge you to just go on YouTube and look at Run Like a Girl. It's fabulous. The things like that change a lot. The answer is the jury is out, but there is a fair amount of investment going on right now in many places around the world to present different images and positive images of strong girls and women. We see this in Malawi. We see it in Rwanda. There's a campaign in India progress. There's a group called Girl Effect working out of London but around the world. And there is evidence that it makes a difference. There is substantial evidence that social media makes a difference. And today's generation of young people, those born between 1997, 98, and 2011 or 12, really cue in to messages on social media. While I say the jury is out with real empirical evidence, it's beginning to indicate, yes, kids hear this, they cue into it, and they resonate with the images that they're seeing.
Let's take another call now. Jerry in Lake Mills. Go ahead, Jerry.
I lay a lot of this blame at the foot of all the religions of the world that seem to indicate that boy children are superior to women, and it continues forevermore. In the United States, a man was able to beat his wife to death without any repercussions by simply because she disobeyed. This is absolute nonsense, and it continues and continues. And I don't think that there's going to be any change for women as far as equality, as long as religions are powerful in the world.
Dr. Bloom?
Well, first, I would say I would not lay responsibility on when anyone thinks. So the young people get messages from faith leaders about gender stereotypes, yes. They absolutely do. But do they get them from teachers? Yes. How do they get them from teachers? You've got to go home. You can't wear that here in school. The two of you, you can't sit together. The two of you, you can't talk. So they get messages at home, in school, in the neighborhood, in church, everywhere they are. So it is, from my lens, much more a global story than it is the responsibility of one particular religious group. That's if that makes sense.
Jerry, thanks so much for that comment. And Marty from New Glarus also called in about that, asking how does religion influence these gender stereotypes? So that religion definitely on their minds. The study also observed that girls' mobility is far more restricted than for boys. What do we know about mobility?
Oh, my goodness. So let me just give you one quote. And then I'll elaborate. So when asked when she first realized she was having going into puberty and having periods, a young girl in the Upper Nile in Egypt said, "Yep, I looked in the mirror and I said to myself, 'You're growing. You can't go out anymore.'" What she meant was, she cannot go out anymore. She cannot leave the home. She can't go out of the home without a chaperone. She's going to stop going to school. She's going to do home chores. And she'll be married off by the time she's 14 or 15. That's her future. Why? Because she went into puberty. What we see around the world is that boys start exploring a much wider geographic area. They start moving around town, and girls move less. So their worlds shrink, and boys' worlds expand. So what difference does this make? Well, in fact, it makes a difference at multiple levels. One is that development, your development in mind, is experience-based. The less experience we have, the more constrained is our development. That's number one. So it impacts girls' development. Secondly, it diminishes opportunities. If you can't have as much mobility, you don't have as many opportunities to try out different things. And so girls pay a very, very high price for this kind of limitation on movement.
And I'm going to stop you right there. We are talking about gender stereotyping this hour. The World Health Organization seeks to use this study as a jumping-off point to create programs that change gender norms before children reach age 15. Dr. Robert Bloom is with us. He directed the study titled "It Begins at 10, How Gender Expectations Shape Early Adolescence Around the World." The study was published in the Journal of Adolescent Health. Your thoughts on where we should go next with gender roles, gender stereotypes in your life? What do you tell your children? 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Back after this news. A comprehensive new study of children and their parents around the world finds that gender stereotypes run deep in kids, and they're set early on in life. We're talking about this recent study in the Journal of Adolescent Health. Dr. Robert Bloom stays with us. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Dr. Bloom directed the study chair and is with Johns Hopkins University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What were your experiences growing up as a boy or a girl? When did you have some gender aha moments? 800-642-1234. Post your thoughts on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And Dr. Bloom, we've seen much advertising through the years. There's this commercial, it's a decade old, but it was released by Hasbro about their rose petal cottage toy, which is a fabric 3D house that has separate rooms, including a laundry room, a nursery, a kitchen. Let's just take a listen. 2007.
Now there's a place.
Come on in.
Where her dreams have room to grow.
It's time to sleep now.
The Rose Petal Cottage.
Find my muffin, it's really yummy.
A place of her very own where she can decorate.
Just can't go here. Just goes here.
Entertain her imagination.
Let's do laundry.
And a special friend or two.
Ta-da!
I love what you've done with the place.
The Rose Petal Cottage. It's her place where her dreams have room to grow.
So do you think we've moved away from this type of advertising, or is it still out there?
Well, I think that it probably is still out there. I think it is less than it was 10 years ago. And I think it is worth keeping in mind and thinking about the dramatic changes that have occurred over the past 30, 40, 50 years around these issues. So if you think about the United States, for example, as one of the folks who called in earlier said, 50 years ago, kids were the property of their parents, and they could beat them. In fact, there was no concept of child abuse before the mid-1970s. Today, children are not the property of their parents, and they cannot beat them at will. The second is that wives were the property of their husbands. So this notion of we have had really stems back to the 1500s in British common law. We have moved substantially away from that. Today, we do not have a notion about bullying that boys will be boys. We say that's off bounds. You cannot talk like that. You cannot act like that. We won't turn our back on that. And so the media messages have followed. Very honestly, there still is, it's suffused with male strength, male dominance, and female passivity.
Let's take another call now. Jason in Menominee. Go ahead, Jason.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. See, I was wondering about your guest comments about boys don't cry. I grew up in a household where it was frowned upon for males to cry, and I found that, later in life, it was a way for me to self-regulate my emotions, and it was the best way for me. And so I'm wondering if you can speak to that a little bit.
Well, I did mention earlier that men have a shorter life expectancy than women. How we are taught to regulate ourselves is very socially determined, and it is influenced by family and by social messages around us. And so we do pay an extremely high price for that kind of mindset. And I think that that's a terrifically good example that you gave. Very honestly, I also have done research on children in the military. And children whose mothers and fathers were deployed, three, four, five times deployed, and the messages in different branches of the military they received. And in those branches of the military where kids grew up with the message, keep it in, be tough. This is the way you support your mother or father who's a soldier. We saw far, far, far greater emotional problems than in the branches where the kids were encouraged to express their emotions, where there was counseling, where there was group support, et cetera. That notion of hold it in and be tough has a cost for kids.
Well, Jason, thanks so much for your call. Dr. Bloom, should adolescent health programs be completely reinvented?
Well, I think that we've made some strides here. And remember, what we're talking about is not about sex and sexual behavior. What we're talking about is human relations and human behavior. So in schools that teach respect for everyone, and not only teaches it, but conveys these messages and sets very clear boundaries that disrespect and disrespectful interchange is totally unacceptable, takes a step in the right direction. Places that provide opportunities for girls as well as boys shift that balance. Where boys and girls are taught to interact as human beings and not sexual beings, they reinforce those messages of competence. So we do have programs and we do have schools where fundamentally teach this. So I'm not really thinking or advocating we need one more program in the school. What I am saying is we need to look at the culture of places where young people interact and say, how do we create safe spaces for them? How do we create a place where girls and boys have equal voice? Where they have opportunities to interact, even as they're going through puberty, as human beings, and learn each other's skills and competences, as well as differences.
Well, and I'm wondering what we tell our children. I have an 8-year-old, and she often wonders, she said, is there something in the job description of the president that it has to be a male who takes that job? Is it written into the job description? And I don't know what to tell her. I tell her it's a fluke, that it's just a fluke that there hasn't been a female president. But I don't know what to tell girls. I'm not, and I don't have the psychological training to even know what to say.
Oh, I would suggest you do. So I would suggest you don't need a psychologist training to know what to do. I think that we all know fundamentally how we want to be treated, whether we're male or female. We all know that respect is the cornerstone of building a relationship. We all know that being cared for matters, whether you're male or female. And that it's legitimate to express that. We all know that bullying and victimizing other people is bad news, and that's off bounds and not tolerated. And we all know that not speaking up for yourself is also bad news and problematic. So what are the messages we want to give our kids about speaking up? What about just going along with the flow in the crowd? About questioning? About how we present ourselves as people? That's what we're talking about. And we don't need a psychologist's degree to have this conversation.
Where does the study go from here?
Well, what we're interested now in doing is that we're moving now into a second phase of research. We're looking at programs and interventions around the world that really aim to create environments in schools by and far, but sometimes these are for out-of-school kids in youth centers, et cetera, that aim to create more gender equitable environments. And there's a program for 10, 11, 12-year-olds, and we're going to follow them over time. What we're interested in is that over time, does this kind of programming reduce gender-based violence and sexual violence? Does it improve mental health outcomes and reduce depression? Are girls more likely to stay in school because of this and complete their education rather than dropping out? These are the things we're interested in. Are girls less embarrassed by and experience more depression over puberty as they do now than boys, or does that shift? So we want to see what works, and then how do you take that to scale? How do you implement what works in this whole school district? Remember, we work in the poorest and most disadvantaged communities in the world. And very honestly, if it can work in those settings, including in the United States, it can work anywhere.
Well, Dr. Robert Bloom, thanks so much for joining us this morning. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me. Have a good morning.
You too. Dr. Robert Bloom is the William H. Gates Senior Professor at Johns Hopkins University's Bloomberg School of Public Health. He recently directed a study titled "It Begins at 10, How Gender Expectations Shape Early Adolescence Around the World." This hour of The Morning Show was produced by Niaja Ellison. Michelle Johnson is executive producer, and she provided technical direction. I'm Kate Archer Kent, and it's conversations like these that you can find on the Ideas Network. Stay with us.